This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Vincent Law. He blogs at Atavistic Intelligentsia and runs the Red Dawn podcast on that site. Vincent, great talking to you.
Hey, it's good to be on.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pillator.
Hi, Vince.
Hey.
Vincent, can you tell us about your background? You currently live in Russia. You're originally from the United States, but you're from a Russian background.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a Slav. I'm from Ukraine, but I spent most of my life in the United States. And then I've been living in Russia for a while now. So, yeah, that's the short story.
We recently had Anatoly Karlin on the show. And he's been a regular. He kind of had the same background where he moved to the United States and he recently just moved back to Russia.
Yeah, you know, I've noticed that there are a lot of people that have done that, actually. It seems like there's a reverse wave. For a while, everyone just wanted to get out and go to the West. But now there's this sort of steady flow back. And it's a trickle right now, but it might turn into a stream if things keep getting worse in the West.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, there's this whole thing. This is kind of the cliche, right? In America, the global elites have pretty much duped everyone in the Midwest working class, and now they go live in exotic countries like France and Japan, and basically everywhere where they do globalized work, and they leave their home country behind, left to everyone else at the bottom. Kind of like the Jetsons, where everyone has a tower at the top, but we never know what's at the bottom of those sky towers.
Yeah, well, as for the whole movement to Eastern Europe, I think we're going to see a lot of white immigration in the coming years. I think we already see it starting with Sweden. A lot of them seem to be interested in moving to Central Europe. I wonder why. But as for the Slav immigration back to Eastern Europe, a lot of it is just these people that left during the 90s, during this period of intense instability. And, you know, things have really improved and leveled out. So, you know, if they didn't really set down roots in the West, it makes sense that they would head back.
What were some of the main factors of you moving to Russia, and was it a difficult transition, or were you already pretty much ingrained in the culture?
I don't know. I mean, you mentioned elites sort of ditching their homelands to basically go wherever they want. And that's a real phenomenon, I think, and it's part of the phenomenon of nomadism. So for me, growing up in the United States and having all these sort of Soviet values, it's not really that I was kind of like one of the Jetsons hopping in a flying car and, you know, just quitting for an exotic locale. I mean, for me, it was like, hey, some of these American values that I keep hearing about and that I sort of find myself immersed in, they don't really speak to me. And, you know, You gotta go back to your roots, man. You gotta figure out what you're all about, where you come from, and all of that. So, it's like a roots thing, except for white people.
Yeah. Well, with me, I mean, my background ancestry is pretty mixed up. I don't really have like one country that I'm connected enough to.
Like I said, I have a flag of Kazakhstan in my room. Or,
you're not Kazakh.
I know, that's the thing. So I joke and say, oh, you must be Eurasian, Pillator. Or basically, maybe a flag of Okinawa. And just work it from there. I don't know, but something like that.
Are you like one of those quarter Scotch, quarter Irish, quarter... Yeah, yeah, you're like, okay.
And I'm like around a quarter Danish, a quarter Polish, like one-eighth German, a little bit English, a little bit Welsh, a little bit Norwegian, a little bit Jewish.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I think it's a lot of people in America share that sort of mixed white ancestry. And a lot of them sort of feel disconnected from something. They feel like they don't really have a culture of their own. And a lot of times they'll just sort of choose one of those fragments that are the most interesting and they'll just roll with it. They'll be like, yeah, I'm Welsh or whatever, and get really into Welsh stuff. So I totally understand that impulse, though. I think to get like intellectual and everything, if you just read a little bit of Heidegger and get past all the tough stuff. Basically, what he's saying is that the world we are born into is ethnic. And really, you have to, if you don't understand where you came from, it, like a tree, if you don't understand your roots, there's no way you can, it's like being born blind. You know, you need to, you are an inheritor of the dreams and ambitions and past works of your ancestors. And so you really got to know where you're coming from. And if you really believe in genes and all of that, you could take it as far as to say that you're kind of programmed in your genes. Like, what makes you happy? What will give you fulfillment? Your understanding of yourself really is tied up in your understanding of your ancestry. But, you know, that might be taking it too far. What do you think?
Yeah, that's definitely a crucial factor. And with the cultural divides, when you moved to Russia, did you automatically connect with the Russian people, or did you feel any differences? Like, do they view you as American, and were there any cultural barriers?
No, I mean, it was, it's, despite the fact that I pretty much had forgotten the language when I first moved there, I quickly picked it back up, and it felt like putting on an old pair of boots that I had broken in and hadn't worn in a very long time. It felt cozy, and yeah, really quick assimilation, you could say.
You recently wrote this post about Russia, and it's called From Russia with a Shove. And you talk about some of the generation gaps. You talk about the older people who grew up under communism, the people who grew up in, during the instability of the 90s, and then the younger generation today, people under the age of people in their teens and 20s who are heavily westernized.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're heavily westernized, but they're certainly different from the generations that preceded them. Russia, in many ways, I don't know how much you get into, how much you've listened to Bodin, but he has this one great hypothesis about why Eastern Europe sort of remains more traditional and less paused than the West. And that seems counterintuitive, seeing as communism you know, was in control in Eastern Europe. And he makes the point that the Iron Curtain ended up preserving under permafrost a lot of the aspects of what it means to be a traditional European. Because, you know, as bad as economic Marxism was, it wasn't as bad as the cultural Marxism and liberalism that the West was subjected to.
So yeah, really, I mean, it's bad for the people who lived under it, but in a sense, it kind of froze the era in time like a museum, and then allowed people to kind of start over from scratch while the American Western system and the system in Western Europe kind of caused a lot of permanent damage.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about the generation gap. You have a lot, in the 90s, you basically had a complete collapse and a complete loss of faith. And it was a really earth-shattering event, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and what happened afterwards, the complete failure of the 90s. So a lot of people got really black-pilled, to use a term from the movement. They got really depressed and cynical, and, I mean, lives were just destroyed, savings destroyed, your place in society was uprooted, and all of a sudden what used to be considered bad, like in terms of values, was suddenly considered great and good. So a lot of people kind of dug their heels in and got really red-pilled by this experience, and they ended up really ultra-conservative and more sort of like they came out of it without, like, to explain it this way, if you were living in late 70s in the Soviet Union and you wanted the jeans and the CDs and the bubblegum and Star Wars or something like that, and you kind of fell for the promise of Westernism, right, of soft pop culture and consumer goods that are really nifty. After living through the 90s, a lot of these people ended up rejecting this sort of optimism and attitude towards the West. And they came out of it jaded, but also red-pilled about the true nature of, you know, capitalism. And so when you have Putin coming into power and the 2000s and the slow climb back to stability, you basically had people who got a crash course in free market capitalism, and they didn't like it one bit. So you had a reaction to it, and people became much more sort of culturally conservative and economically to the left, I suppose you could say.
What happened under Yeltsin is he privatized the economy, and all the wealth went to the oligarchs. And then there was also a lot of issues. There was the American cultural influence and a lot of the issues with Islamic terrorism in Chechnya. And Putin sort of clamped down on a lot of that. But what's interesting about Putin's economic policies is, on one hand, he has like a flat tax, but there is a lot of protectionism and a lot of economic institutions are state utilities. So he is kind of an interesting hybrid between right-wing economics and economic populism. But he's improved the economy greatly from the Yeltsin era.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Would you say, on economics, would you say you're somewhat to the left?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm pretty much a social nationalist. If you just flip the terms, I think you'd understand what I mean.
What would you say, because we were talking about decade periods, I think a red-pilling moment in America, especially with the transformation of into the alt-right, would probably have to be 9/11 in 2001 when, you know, the Twin Towers were exploded by, you know, Muslim terrorists by that sort. And everyone knew the blame was pretty much on Israel and our reaction with helping with Jews. And so there was much more skepticism about having Jewish alliances. And so you have these things like this whole anti-Israel and pro-Palestine movement, you know, Norman J. Finkelstein, or G. Sinkelstein, and more of that kind of critical to Israel, but pro-Palestine. And I think that was kind of almost a fad in the zeros, the 2000s, and now we're in this weird alt-right thing from, I don't know, what are your thoughts on 9/11? The pro-Palestine was basically a soft, politically correct version of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, honestly, I wasn't really... 9/11 wasn't a big red-pilling moment for me. I didn't really understand the significance of it. I just sort of was like, all right, I mean, America was funding all these groups to fight the Soviet Union, so they just got bit in the ass, and they kind of had it coming. That was my original take on it. I was like, you reap what you sow, bitch. But as I got more involved in, like, understanding what really went down, I mean, you just sort of understand that it's really hard to be a patriot of any country, a real patriot any day, and American patriots in general, the ones that aren't just about, okay, like, to take a step back, Bushism really, I think, set back conservatism in America, and if it weren't for Trump, I'd say, you know, Bushism was fatal to American conservatives, because it became associated with this sort of foam finger wearing, Bud Light chugging, USA chanting, Jesus freak, menagerie of people that, you know, it's like if you had any sort of triple digit IQ, you sort of could see the holes in what they were saying, and you could feel that what they were doing was wrong, Iraq was wrong, and, you know, there was a lot wrong with it. And so a lot of people that were growing up in that time, in that era, ended up sort of turning to John Stewart, and they started thinking of themselves as liberal because liberal became associated with anti-war and anti-Bush hypocrisy. That being said, once Bush was gone and we had Obama, I mean, listen, I didn't actually vote because I live in a place where my vote doesn't count. But when Obama got elected the first time, I ran down to the White House, and I was totally enthused about it. I thought this was going to change everything. I even hauled a fat Mexican on my shoulders and let him wave an American flag right at the White House gates. So, I mean, let's just say, like, I was at that point right around 2008. But, you know, I guess it's like Richard Spencer says. I mean, people just get red-pilled by reality. You start understanding that, you know, there really isn't a two-party state. Just because Obama said some nice things doesn't mean he had any political clout or even the desire to change anything. It was just, you know, two heads of the same beast. The Bush doctrine and the neocons, they carried on into Obama's presidency. So, you know, Trump was like the real return of American patriotism. And I mean, that's a really enheartening movement. And even here in Russia, people are like totally ecstatic about Trump, just over the top. Trump this, Trump that. Trump is trying to be our friend. Trump is an honorary Cossack. Trump is actually descended from the Rurikid dynasty. He's got like
his wife's Albanian, you know. I don't know how Albania says, but
yeah, I've legit heard that like Trump is actually secretly Russian royalty. That I've heard that said before on the media. So Trump mania is over the top here. So yeah, it's been a wild ride, I think, for everybody. I never got into the Ron Paul stuff. I never really understood it. When he got into the whole there should be no public schools, I was like, what the hell is this guy smoking? But I guess that's just my, you know, communist upbringing.
Yeah, well, I think it's crucial to kind of bring in factions of the disaffected left. The left liberal establishment is kind of a coalition of SJWs and neoliberalism, but I think it's crucial to incorporate these issues like pro-worker, pro-environment, anti-war, and appeal to a lot of the disaffected Bernie Sanders supporters.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the people I knew in university who were hippies were the most open-minded people about this sort of stuff. I mean, listen, if someone is willing to talk about third eyes and astral planes, you know, you can drop a little red pill in here and there, and they'll be like open-minded or toked up enough to actually hear you out. So I'm all for that. And Der Fuhrer himself, I mean, some of the best people that joined the SS were disaffected communists. They were the best frontline street fighters that Hitler had in some cases. So, you know, there's something to be said about tapping into the fact that there are a lot of legitimate issues that the old left could raise up in criticism of the policies that started either under Reagan or under Clinton, depending on where you draw the line with like NAFTA, right? Exporting all these jobs overseas and not caring about American working class. I mean, those are all legitimate grievances that the old left, if it existed, could take up and rally behind. And if they had, I mean, maybe some of us wouldn't be on the alt-right today. Maybe some of us would just be like, you know, old school lefties still. But they didn't. And so that's how the alt-right was born.
I know Trump has incorporated aspects of that where he appealed to a lot of those like old school Union Democrats and working class whites in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, Michigan. And in Europe, the same trend has happened where a lot of former working class white labor voters have voted for Nigel Farage and the Brexit. And a lot of former socialists have been backing Le Pen. So I see that trend happening. On economics, what do you think about the whole concept of kind of like a Bobo nationalism or Swipple nationalism? You wrote about that kind of in reference to Richard Spencer.
Yeah, it's not just Richard Spencer though. It's a lot of the crowd of the alt-right. If you go enough to the meetups and stuff, you start noticing tendencies. For the most part, almost everybody is upper middle class, or you know, lower, I'd say upper class. And one of the reasons why they are drawn to the alt-right is because it subtly signals that it is not like the KKK or, you know, some sort of pro-Confederacy, pro-movement. One of the cleverest things that Spencer did was, so to take a step back, libertarianism was an interesting exercise in 2008, I think, of subtle counter-signaling. If you wanted to be a conservative, but you didn't want to associate with Jesus freaks, Bible thumpers, I mean, I'm using these terms pejoratively, but you know, I'm not like denigrating these people. I'm just pointing out that if you didn't want to be associated with this sort of evangelical guns and Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve type conservatism, libertarianism was the place for you. You could basically say, I'm fiscally conservative, but socially liberal. In other words, you wouldn't get ostracized by your peer circle. You could still be trendy and cool, but you could still counter-signal your liberal peers. And you could, most importantly, distance yourself from these more pro elements of conservatism. And a lot of the people in libertarianism were these like triple-digit IQ, smart guys that like to wear dapper suits and sort of wink that they were against liberalism, but they were also clever and they weren't associated with the idiots that voted for Bush. So it's all about the people that you will find yourself around. If you go to MPI and you find people in overalls there, you're not going to go back, right? If you're part of this class and if you've come to these conclusions through intellectual growth or experimentation, right? But if you go there and you see people well-dressed that seem to be from the same socioeconomic background as you, all of a sudden you feel a lot more at ease about embracing what could be considered, you know, faux pas social values that the alt-right espouses. So the fact that a lot of the leaders of the alt-right and a lot of the members of the alt-right are former libertarians should come as no surprise to anybody. They were counter-signaling a lot of people back in the day, and now in the alt-right, they basically take the next step and they counter-signal people within libertarianism and decided to really hone down on what they stood for. But I think in the future, now that the core has formed and now that the alt-right has differentiated itself from neocons, from Bushism, from just like basic bitch conservatism of the 21st century in America, the alt-right should start not being so, you know, upper middle class. They should be reaching out to people of different socioeconomic backgrounds. And we'll see if it does.
I think there can be both. I think the economic issues can appeal to the working class, like Union Democrat types. And then I think there's also can be room for a kind of a like Swipple nationalism. I think both can exist.
Well, you know, like most libertarians were kind of rich. Like, let's be honest, I used to spend some time in libertarian circles. These guys are not going to work in a factory. Let's just put it that way.
Well, sure, definitely.
So for them to argue against unions and to make these arguments for free market economics, it's like, sure, dude, I'm sure that benefits you. I'm sure you'll do quite fine as like a think tank dude wearing your bow tie and, you know, your stupid tassel loafers. I mean, that makes perfect sense. You're arguing for what's in your class interests. The only thing, there were also just middle class libertarians who like to LARP as if they were like big business owners or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, all these people would like get so up in arms about the fucking inheritance tax. It's like, what are you, why are you so up in arms about this? You're not going to leave $3 billion to your kids. Why? I mean,
most of them act like autistic robots too. You can't tell if they're just a patient of autism or they're just like, they're trying to be intellectual and they talk and they're like well-versed in everything when they're just phony and talking out their ass.
Here's the thing. This gets into like a theory that we're really pushing on Red Dawn, and it's the bronze, silver, gold, soul theory. And it's also a class-based theory that the middle class has no conception of itself as being middle class. It thinks that it is actually upper class. And so it apes what they think that the upper class does. So they think that the upper class spends all its time like sipping champagne, eating caviar, going to the opera, and all that. When in all reality, the upper class actually just slums it all the time, does cocaine, and their kids listen to rap. Like,
it's true. Oh, yeah. And they're just, as F. Roger Devlin said, sexual utopia and power. It's also a sexual decadent thing where it's basically like you just said, it's like the Devlin quickly said, the reason why there's like low white birth rates is because the women's sexuality has been trashed so much that she only looks after the higher ups. And it gives basically no one, you know, someone to have a wife and kids. It gives everyone the upper class, like a promiscuous playboy-like mentality. But yeah, it's a really, a lot of that's happening.
And what's happening in our society is the economics are more, there's more income inequality, but the culture is becoming more kind of decadent, where the rich are emulating the kind of the behavior that you would describe as kind of low class, and then but at the same time with this kind of crass materialism. Where I'm coming from my class background, is my background's pretty confusing because I grew up in LA. My family's income was fairly middle class. We lived in our grandparents' home, which they they bought the house back in the 70s when it was cheap. It was in a very wealthy area where a lot of Hollywood types lived. Then I went to a high school that was very ghetto because of busing. And then I'm also someone who is kind of culturally into kind of a lot of the Swipple things. Like, I'm an artist, and I like sushi and like sipping like chai lattes. But on the
I'm Swipple too. I just hang out with Asian Americans most of the time, so it's a pan Asian American Swipple thing, which I basically make up in an ideology. But yeah, we're
but
all
on economics. I'm more because I've struggled economically.
On the
I'm
Jewish
more
side.
I'm more no. I'm more populist, so ironically, that's kind of the background of a lot of these liberal Bernie Sanders supporters and even SJWs, where they're culturally Swipple but economically struggling. But that's kind of where I'm coming from. Except well, I'm red-pilled on a lot of the other issues you talk about.
Same.
Yeah, but you know the whole Swipple thing. It's basically it's this. You know, Plato talks about it. It's basically these people. And, you know, this sort of three-pronged thing where you have bronze, silver, gold souls, this pattern repeats itself in just about everything in terms of IQ, in terms of your political ideology, in terms of just in terms of meta-truth-seeking. For example, do you know that most voters who vote conservative have lower IQ? Liberals like to point that out, and they say that, you know, most people who vote conservative have lower IQ, which is true. We call them the natural conservatives. They vote conservative because of this gut reaction. They say Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Like, that's the length of their, you know, intellectual journey. Or you know, that's how they see things. They just kind of feel through it. And then you have, these are the bronze souls, I suppose you could call them. Then you have the next slightly higher IQ group, and those are the liberal voters. And they vote for, you know, liberals. And they are basically counter-signaling against the proles by embracing everything that they have, that they perceive to be prole values. So if they see proles, you know, disgusting, like they don't take care of themselves, they wear jeans all the time and white shirts and, you know, Homer Simpsons, right? So, like, what does a slightly smarter person like Lisa Simpson do? She becomes a liberal. But then you have a slightly higher IQ people at the very top. They become conservative again. And so you have this strange dynamic where in the middle, these silver-souled people are the liberal voters. They're also in the middle socioeconomically. It's the middle class with these middle-class values, especially upper middle class, that vote for these, you know, liberal talking points because they're counter-signaling against the proles, and then the proles counter-signal against them. So if they start driving Priuses, the prole knee-jerks and starts driving a pickup truck, a gas guzzler. You know, should the prole be anti-environment? No, he doesn't think of it that way. What he's doing is he's just giving a big middle finger to that smug Prius-driving middle-class Swipple who thinks he's smarter than him, right?
And that's so an emotional gut reaction, as you said. It's not really rationally thought out. I mean, we had this guest talking about rationalism, and his politics, I'd say, are more a lot different than yours. He's more like he hates Donald Trump, but I would say I would recommend listening to the interview because I do think he has a lot of valid points that people do have these visceral responses. They see all these – you have these working class conservatives who see rich liberals being into environmentalism. So then they want to do like the polar opposite, yeah. But they don't rationally think about what is best for their own interest.
Yes, that's exactly true. I mean, that is – I could – that is 100% true. I totally agree with that. It's just the interesting thing is that this sort of constant this constant signaling and counter-signaling between the lower class or the working class, as it is euphemistically called, and the middle class explains a lot of voting patterns. The third element, which is like the even higher IQ or the aristocrats or whatever, they're too insignificant in terms of numbers to change anything one way or the other, but they're also something worth mentioning because Trump is a great example of it. Trump is an example of Caesarism. And Caesarism is when a guy who's like a, basically an aristocrat, like an upper class leader, makes an appeal to the proles, and he circumvents the middle because he knows that his alliance, you know, the middle will never vote for him. They don't like him. He doesn't stand for their values. He doesn't act the way that they perceive an upper class aristocrat should act. And so he appeals to the proles. And this relationship between a king, for example, and the serfs, this love affair between the king and the serfs, and the hate that the serfs have for the boyars or for the lords or the barons, or, you know, the fact that the working class hates the bourgeoisie, you know, but they love the Kaiser or something like that. This sort of alliance between prole and aristocrat, it really came out in Trump. Trump tapped into that, in that feeling of disgust, and Michael Moore totally nailed it on the head as well when he said that all these people that voted for Trump just wanted to throw a Molotov cocktail into the White House. Yeah, that's what they wanted to do. You guys should have seen it coming.
You have this recent article, well, not recent, but from October, the PAWS is a weapon of class warfare. And PAWS is an alt-right term. I think it's like a reference to HIV. But you start off with talking about your experience going to prep school for high school.
Yeah. No. That it's the PAWS. I don't know who can be credited with using it first, whether it's TRS or MPC, but whatever, it's a good term, so we're gonna stick with it. It refers to this like habit of gay people, some sexual deviants, to intentionally get affected with HIV, and the parallels to like Germany, for example, intentionally getting infected with a huge Muslim invasion, right? It's this sort of, when a society goes mad and starts doing things that self-harm and gets a sick pleasure out of doing it. That's the metaphor, right? So in general, what I was going with that article was I was trying to say that even though a lot of these, like, you know, insulated swipples and, you know, upper class types, even though they will openly mouth off and preach these values of diversity, multiculturalism, whatever stupid social cause of the day they've decided to rally around, they're pretty much insulated from the effects of what's happening. I mean, a lot of people have commented on that before, but what I said was that, but this is intentional. You see, it's part of this striver mentality. It's part of the keeping up with the Joneses. You know, it gets to the point where it's not even about, improving your position over the Joneses. If you can make them relatively worse off, your position relatively improves compared to them. So one of the strategies you could employ is, it's like, doling out the radiation, right? You just you make things worse for everybody, but you know you can handle it better. It's like putting your hand on the burner. You know that you can, like, both you and your opponent put your hand on the hot plate, right? But you know you can handle the pain more than your opponent, so you're fine with technically making things worse off for yourself as well, as long as you can get that edge over the other guy. So that's what the whole idea is that they mouth off these platitudes, and they know that they're more insulated, and they know that they can rise relative to them, to the people they're counter-signaling against.
And sure, there are generally people who are liberals and they're compassionate people who want to help the poor, but you're talking about people who are status conscious and a virtue signal.
Yeah, but like there's this special position that a lot of people in America find themselves in, where they're not quite aristocrats, not quite upper class. They're in that little... they have to make that final leap, you know? They're upper middle class. And this is where the striving kicks into high gear. You know, if you're a prole, if you're just a typical working class guy, this keeping up with the Joneses bullshit, they do not do that as much as these people who think that they're so close to making it to the top. And they're so obsessed with making it to the top. And so once you get to that point, they become hypersensitive to all these perceived social faux pas, and these people end up being the most paused, even though they're the most insulated from the paused. So in high school, I went to a very good prep school. And you see a lot of that. You see, like, the kids of either, like, straight-up upper-class kids who are pretending to be black. You know, they're like, they got their Air Jordans, snapback, I don't know, like, they're wearing do-rags sometimes. It's like, what are you doing? You know, smoking weed, of course, doing drugs.
Well, you even see that in, like, cheesy Hollywood teen films.
Yeah. But it's like, and then they listen to rap, and they pretend that they are, and they start talking as if they're these, like, lower class apes, right? And you're like, why are they doing this?
You know, it's funny, on the East Coast, it still is today, like, punk hardcore music basically means white upper class dumb. At one point in time, punk hardcore was basically, like, a lower class white thing, but now it's been culturally reappropriated to mean, all right, if you're into punk hardcore, you're just exactly like the people you're saying, right? They're these whites that wear their black t-shirts of, like, no name bands of, like, whatever, and they're basically trying to be, yeah. But no, they got the trust fund babies, they got all this money, yeah. And they go to shows, and they have girlfriends, they have every luxurious thing, and pretend they're the Antifa, yeah. Basically.
Yeah, I was about to say, if I wanted to join a white organization, I would drop the alt-right in a heartbeat, and I would join Antifa. That thing is 99% white.
Because they all come from that stupid punk hardcore culture, and basically it's an upper-class thing, and it's all this victim mentality.
It's not quite upper-class. It's upper-middle-class. They're precarious. They're about to make that. They're super swipples. Antifa is the final evolutionary form. you could argue that the hippie... I took a trip to the Caribbean recently, actually, and I saw these hippies on an island, and this island, how do I put it? Like, do you know anything about Caribbean culture? It's basically there were these Indians that lived there, and then the whites came and settled, but then they started importing slaves, and the slaves revolted, and then the islands became black and mired in poverty until tourism came in, like, the 70s and the 80s, right? So you had this, like, one island where these hippies had settled. And the funny thing is, like, it was just this one little place on the island chain. And every other island where there weren't white hippies living is just a total dump. And
what island are you talking about? It was interesting.
I'm talking about the Virgin Islands. Sorry.
Oh, the Virgin Islands. That's interesting because some places in the Caribbean, I know, like Jamaica, have a lot of horrible poverty and crime. In the case of the British Virgin Islands, they're a really nice place because basically the Rockefeller family bought up all the wilderness as an ecological preserve, and that's really great, but that it's sort of a very exclusive place.
No, but not only him, but Sir Richard Branson has an island there.
Oh, yeah.
And, the Google people, I don't know their names, whatever, one of them bought an island as well, and it's pretty secure, but like... What I'm trying to say is that so the locals don't give a okay, you go to the hippies and they're growing organic local fruits, right? They're doing local handicraft. They're preserving the culture, the unique culture of the island. But then you go to the actual with the actual people that the culture they're preserving where they live, and they have none of that, right? They're completely sold on the Western model of just cars and like looking like they're from the West. There's no local handicrafts. There's no local culture. It doesn't look anything like what the hippies have created. And so you realize that the only people that took a damn any interest in it are the swiffle hippies that came to this island, created a little enclave for themselves, and started preserving the culture of these people who don't even give enough of a damn to preserve it themselves. It's such a white thing to do. It's just amazing.
I guess that's, everywhere. You call them cucks when you point them out that they're not being racially aware, or at least that they're working against their own interest. I mean...
See, I wouldn't say that. I'd say, like, I mean, like, it's just a white thing to do of a certain class. I mean, white people are just fascinated by all these more primitive cultures. They'll go to Japan. They'll go to India.
Yes.
Yeah. Japan was interesting is I know like white liberals are interested in more primitive cultures. A lot of people on the right are fascinated with Japan because it's this very kind of a advanced futuristic society with an ancient.
Because of the anime, dude. It's because of the anime.
Yeah, anime.
And let me tell you something about the anime, right? I know like 3-4 white friends that all have Asian girlfriends, right? I bring up the issue with three
yes,
of them,
yes.
And they're all like, dude, that's awesome that you got an Asian girl. That's so amazing. Oh, this has nothing to do that I have an Asian girlfriend. She's a universal being that I, you know, the typical Sweple stuff. In a way, I think that is cuckery. I call that new cuck stuff. Not only that you're a cuck because you're not within race, you're this new neo-cuck for even denying the sake that you've even chosen or even want to ignore discrimination on that matter. I mean, if you have a Eurasian child or Hapu offspring, you got to take destiny or responsibility for that. But they're going to treat it as, oh, no, he's just an individual, white individual. This whitewashing among Asians seems to be a very disorder, as if like that's it's a bad thing to have, because it's almost white people want to whitewash other things so they can culturally appropriate things, but at the same time it's like better to have something that's Asian Aryan that isn't naively cucked, right?
Well, I would cucked. What this is, again, like you mentioned, the Swipple phenomenon. It's going native, you know. Like, we don't have any culture of our own, but they have it because they're so charmingly primitive. White people have this, like, Lawrence of Arabia instinct of a certain class, of a certain... like, if they live in a 99% upwardly mobile area for too long in the suburbs, like, they just kind of snap and they want to become all, like... They want to get authentic and all original. And God forbid they should go to their own roots, because that's problematic. You know, that's very
whole kind of a cultural appropriation, like Lawrence of Arabia thing. What's ironic is back in the 1920s, all this really great sort of Middle Eastern Moorish revival architecture was built in California. But that was actually when California was the most Anglo. That was before we got all these immigrants. But
The Anglo is the ultimate Swipple. You must, have you guys taken the Anglo pill yet? The Eternal Anglo?
What is that again?
No. The Eternal Anglo? It's just pointing out that the Anglos are like the most Jewish of all the European people.
Oh, I've heard that before. I think maybe
it's very tied up with the WASP question, which is very tied up with the Swipple question. See, this is infrared pill territory, guys. This is the type of stuff that only prime autists, like the one you'll find at.
I'm the yellow pilled, where basically I'm saying it's okay to be with Asians, but Robert has something different. So we all have our forms of pilling.
Yeah, dude, you got to take the Asian pill, though. Like, seriously. There's a, like, you got to listen. We got this Sikh, and he is like, because he's a minority, right? He can say whatever the hell he wants, and he is so red-pilled on the East Asian question. It is just amazing. He's got to set you straight, man.
Mm-hmm. What do you... Oh, you mentioned him on MPI.
Yeah.
Does he have... are you saying his negative views about other Asian groups? Because I know the Sikhs were traditionally marginalized by Muslims and Hindus, so they're generally more pro-Western.
Yeah. The Sikhs were basically used by the British and, well, Germans like them too, as auxiliaries, and they were used to basically rule the local population. But the funny thing about Singh is that he triggers the Swipple instinct even within the alt-right. He is such a star. He is such a star. You would not believe it. Like, he goes to a single event, any conference, anywhere, and they are just fawning over him. They're just so fascinated by him and his culture. And I'm like, this is supposed to be a Nazi, like, far right, you know, like white nationalist conference, and everyone's just totally digging his turban and like thinks he's so interesting.
Yeah.
His Swipple instinct is too strong, I swear.
Yes, exactly. It's always where, hey, look, if you're like Eurasian or something, everyone's got lots to be your friend, right? That's kind of a normal thing, right? Exotic attracts people. I know there's this whole school of Orientalism saying, oh, that's bad, you shouldn't judge a book by its cover. But it's like, sometimes you should judge, but you should always make sure that that instinct shouldn't, you know, over, you know, basic stuff.
You wrote this article, Chad Nationalism is a Bad Idea, and it was in reference to a lot of high IQ intellectuals who are kind of, they're attracted to the alt-right because they're repulsed by the dominant culture of just like these, this kind of a drunken, trashy bro culture.
No, listen, dude. Like, all right, everyone in the alt-right that was talking about Chad nationalism was a total LARPer. I mean, there is no way that, I mean, you meet these guys, like, I'm sorry, but they were not living the Chad nationalist dream.
Even if you go on a site like Roosh, like, you can tell, like, all these guys were, like, former nerds, or most of them.
Yeah, yeah, no, let's just be honest about what we are. We are all former nerds, and it's the same thing about the bronze, silver, and the gold soul theory. We were all silver souls. We were in the middle. We thought we were, like, either liberals or libertarians, and we were counter-signaling the proles because we didn't like how trashy they were, but now we've come full circle. We've become gold souls, and so we realize the inherent truths of what the bronze souls were doing. It's like a Buddhist parable. This man sets out on a path to enlightenment, and so he comes up to a mountain, and he looks at that mountain, and he says, that is a mountain. Then he goes off for like a year and travels around and gets more enlightened, and he comes back, and he looks back at that mountain, and he says, that is not a mountain. Then he goes off some more and he comes back and now he's enlightened and he looks up at that mountain the third time and he says, that is a mountain, but not because I say it is a mountain, but because it is a mountain. That's how all truth goes through these stages. First, it's this gut thing. Then you counter-signal against it. Then you come to a renewed understanding of it once you've already rejected it. You re-accept it, but now you understand why. So I get why they're like saying, oh yeah, shit, you know, men need to be men and we need to be masculine and we need to take back our society. But don't, you know, be honest about what you are, man. Like,
yeah, they always say like, oh, right-wing men are alpha and liberals are beta cucks. But I mean, that's kind of simplistic. A lot of so-called Chads are people who pretty much they just care about getting by in society and yeah. Political dissident movements like the alt-right are filled up with a lot of nerdy guys, so it's kind of,
you know, it's
know
like, it seems guy. Like Chad nationalism is a perfect definition for Identity Europa at the current moment. When you had Trad Youth, which was Matthew Heimbach, Matt Parrott, I'm not going to lie, Matt Parrott's got, he's big boned, he's got some weight on him, you know, even though he might be showing he has a kid, a family, he had, you know, and him associating with neo-Nazis, everybody on the alt-right said, no, we don't want anything to do with Heimbach. All of a sudden, this guy, Nathan D'Amigo, comes out of the military, has, you know, tattoos, bro-like. He looks like some guy at an avant-garde punk show, whatever. And then all of a sudden, him and his bro, Identity Europos, who are maybe all closet gays, possibly, you know, are showing this Chad nationalism. Once again, I'm not hating on Identity Europa. This is just the way I see it. And so identitarianism is basically, I think, a manifestation of this Chad nationalism you're talking about, where people want to be this fash cut thing or this jock that was.
Yeah,
this,
but it's not a jock. Again, there's a lot of overlap between the gold and the bronze soul but there's a difference, you know? You have, it's like one is a state of enlightenment that's natural enlightenment. It's like, it's even the whole pickup thing, right? You got the natural alphas, guys who don't know what they're doing. They just go to the bar, make some noise. You know, yes. Just go over to the chick with their dick swinging and like they pick her up. They don't know what they're doing, but it works. And then you have the starting struggling PUAs, the slightly like smarter, higher IQ dudes who are nerdier and they're trying to implement some of this stuff and they're failing.
Yeah.
And then you have the true like alpha, the true PUA master who has really mastered the concept. And so he's become, you know, this sort of an enlightened form of the natural alpha. He's become the refined alpha, right? But you cannot, even though there's a lot of similarity between them, you have to understand they went through different journeys, and even though they're natural allies, you could say, they're very similar to one another now, they're quite different as well. So I was trying to make the point that, like, listen, it's not about being a stupid jock. It's about embracing intellectualism and using and genuinely, through an intellectual path, coming to the realization that there are a lot of values that the prole embodies that you should embody as well. You should be like an officer, you know, you should be well put together, you should be intelligent.
Kind of like the kind of warrior intellectual as opposed to kind of the buffoonish Chad.
Like the dad, or the I always say the Christian minister, right? You always go to these clubs and they're like, these new age Christian church will be like, I'm a normal, healthy guy, but did you know I'm a follower of Jesus Christ? You know, this kind of new, that's what I think. The Christian attitude is very helpful, and I'm all for that too, and I've been in that church scene, so I know what there's, but yeah, this man, that's a dad for society, or at least this good role model figure you can trust, you know, not this.
I prefer officer. You're an officer. Yeah.
You did say in your article there's less of a distinction between like a nerd versus Chad culture in Russia.
Yeah, there is. I think it's, you know, in America, there's this sort of like Revenge of the Nerds type dynamic playing out.
But what about the like gangster types with like the stereotype of like the leather jackets and gold chains?
Yeah. So that's like straight up thug. You know what I mean? Like the Chad is perfectly within the boundaries of the law. You know what I mean? Like if your parents gave birth to a Chad, there's no, he's not going to go to jail for being a Chad. I mean, at least like back in the 80s or whatever. It's the Chad is perfectly within the framework of American society. He is the star, actually. He's the football player at Friday Night Lights. He's the guy who gets Stacy. He's the American Dream, the making out on the convertible at Makeout Ridge, right? He is sort of... But in contrast to that, the Russian version of it doesn't really exist. You know what I mean? It's like you could be a thug, right? You could be this gangster, this sort of, a gangster, basically. But that's definitely not like a Chad comparison. That's the closest thing. You know what I'm saying? Like everyone else, there's this culture of, hey, I'm going to do well in school. I'm going to be well-adjusted. And I'm going to get girls, no problem. I'll get a pretty girlfriend. Girls like a smart kid. They like a smart, slightly skinny, high IQ dude that can play the piano. I mean, there's none of that. Yeah, there's none of that. Like, you don't get punished for that as much here in Russia. Like, that's a legit type that girls go for. And it's decent-looking girls that go for it. So you don't really have that sort of constant struggle and the fight between the nerds who just don't get anything and the complete Neanderthals that get everything. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a completely alien concept here.
Yeah, and we kind of had that in America in the past. Like, you had the thugs with the tattoos, like the bikers, but those are the guys who went to prison. But now we're seeing that culture in the upper middle class.
Yeah, I mean, it's LARPing. It's like, if you are in the upper class, there's nowhere else for you to go, right? You can't keep going up. You're already at the top. So where do you go? You go back down. You go slumming. And that's the truth about upper class culture. And it's only, the only people that embody the sort of upper class values that we associate with upper class culture are actually the upper middle class, who are striving to become upper class. And so they mistakenly identify with these ideals that don't actually exist.
You're working on a cyberpunk themed sci-fi novel. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I wrote a first one, and it takes place in St. Petersburg, and I had fun writing it. Like, I genuinely enjoyed writing that book, and I have another one coming up, and since I wrote the first one, I did a lot of more traveling in Europe, meeting up with patriots. And just, actually, again, speaking of slumming it, I would go to all the immigrant districts, like in Stockholm or around Malmo or, so the second book is basically the main character's action-packed journey continues, except now he's going to be in Sweden, and it's going to be a lot of fun describing Sweden.
The one about Russia was already released.
Yeah, Jack's Play, yeah. So the second one's going to be Jack's Raid, and it's going to take place in Sweden. And I think I'm going
to. Do you predict like a complete Islamic takeover?
You know, like my positions have become a lot more nuanced the more time I spend in Russia. I can sort of understand a little bit more tactics of what's happening. The narrative that the sort of Camp of the Saints narrative that this is just how it happens is very compelling, and there's a lot to be gleaned from it, but. Malmo is an interesting example. What's happening in Malmo is these immigrants come, and there's a lot of trouble that's immediately stirred up. Like, you know, crime rises, problems in the suburbs. The police are constantly being undermined, like they're being attacked, and security workers, firefighters, ambulances, they can't get into these areas. Social workers can't get in there either. And you know, a lot of people in the alt-right and just the right-wing in general will say, well, see, that's because they're subhuman savages and they just can't fucking function in a normal society. And they don't understand that this is actually a very clever strategy. What they do is they deny the locals access to the state. And so the locals have to rely on authority structures that emerge from gangs, from Muslim gangs, from Muslim organizations. And so they create these parallel societies where if you actually want something done, if you actually want justice done or access to some government money, you have to go through, you can't just go to the Swedish government or the government of the city of Malmo. You have to go through these parallel organizations. And then the police ends up making deals with them. They say, listen, can you just like keep the quiet in this neighborhood, please? And they say, sure, no thing. No problem. Just give us the authority and look the other way and work with us. And we will keep this powder keg under control. Yeah, what happens is like they stir up these problems when they come to the immigrants come. And then they offer a deal to the authorities and they say, we can keep calm here. We can like keep the peace. Just let us take care of it ourselves. And that's how you see the real takeover happening. That's how you see that's the mechanism. You know, that's the actual, yeah, we can see that, okay, demographics and increased immigration is going to lead to it. But how? And you know, no one actually explains the process of it. So I want to, like, you know, get more into that sort of thing.
So you're not really predicting, like, this violent bloodbath civil war. You're predicting more of a scenario of what happened in California with, like, Mexican and Chinese immigration. But the other trend I think is happening is that a lot of Muslims are turning to kind of Western-style, like, hip-hop culture. I read an interesting comment after one of the terrorist attacks in Europe. Someone said that the young Muslim men, the ones who are the most disaffected, turn to jihad and groups like ISIS, and the ones who are the most socially successful turn to kind of Western-style hedonism and like emulating like black hip-hop culture. Do you see those trends happening?
Yeah, absolutely. Sweden is a great example of this. Like, you'll see that the trendiest white Swedes that hang out all have their token friends, like Arabs with like perfectly greased up hair. I mean, everyone in Stockholm looked way better than me, like when I was there. I mean, really decked out, like totally peacocking over the top.
So you're saying an Arab would have higher status than a Russian guy like you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because first of all, I'm a bad white, right? I'm the type of flyover, hick, Eastern Mongolian savage that the Swedes, you know, hate with a passion. I can't be like, hello, fellow white people, I'm one of you. No, they feel more, they get more social utility out of basically using an Arab, like a well-adjusted, good-looking Arab to join their social circle as kind of like a handbag or other accessory or an iPhone. It's a way of socially signaling, right? So the upper class Swedes and the upper middle class will do that. And they will, like, you know, Stockholm is pretty much, if you live anywhere near the center, like in the good parts of town, and you go out to these incredibly expensive places, yeah, you're well to do. So they basically use them as accessories. And it's that same idea that while the poor working class Swedes have to actually live in neighborhoods with like the worst adjusted and most third world elements of this massive immigration flux, the better offs get to just, you know, drape this accessory on their elbow. You get to Husby and you look at this poster that they draped there, and it's like the council members of the town, and it's these frumpy cat ladies and this eunuch. It's like four cat ladies and some dude who obviously lost his balls in like a radioactive accident 40 years ago. And you understand that, oh my God, the country is run by these people. It's the same women that like do this defiant tweet at Donald Trump. You know, that have you seen that in the news where they? And then while they're in Iran, they put on the hijab or the veil, whatever you want to call that. And it's like the whole country is run by cat ladies and eunuchs and, you know, gay men.
I think the people who focused on Islam, I think that's a threat, but I think that's also can also be a distraction.
I agree, because first of all, a lot of the Arab men I saw there were gay too. I mean, they're getting gayified as it is. In fact, gay culture is inseparable from Islam, if you think about it. Because, you know, Islam allows one man to monopolize about four wives. Well, he can actually, in actual practice, go a lot higher than that if he's like a big, big deal. So if you have one dude that can take four, let's just say four, right, by Islamic law, you have three dudes that have nothing. And so Islam, and what do? Well, they either go out and war and conquer the other tribe, which is why conflict is an inherent part of Islam, because you have all these young men with no women, basically, to tether them down. Or you go gay. And that's why there's a huge gay culture in Islam where hand-holding among men, kissing among men, boy love, which is not considered gay, and all this stuff, like serious flourishing homosexual culture, especially in Iran. And the women totally bankrupt the men as well. And then if they have a daughter, they basically have to send them to all these universities and pay for everything.
it's true.
Patriarchy pretty much there too. So,
since we were on the topic of a cyberpunk, I want to get your thoughts on the cyberpunk aesthetic. I know there's a place in Moscow called a Novi Arbat. It looks really cyberpunk.
Yeah, so the whole cyberpunk thing, it's a really cool aesthetic. Cyberpunk gets a lot wrong. They totally think that the future is going to be some sort of nerd, transhumanist, fetish, jerk-off thing, and it's just not true. I mean, it's a symptom of the Swipple disease, really, where they think that, oh, you know, everyone's going to be like this jockey cowboy that jacks into the system, and he's like mixed race and makes love with some other samurai.
It's a really fetish. Like, yeah, it's a fetishizing thing.
It's also kind of a 80s nostalgia, too.
Exactly.
Definitely. Definitely.
That image I sent you, when was that? Was that stuff from the kind of the 90s era, or is that more recent from the Novi Arbat?
You know what? I will go there since I'm in Moscow right now, and I know Arbatskaya Ulitsa, and I've been meaning to go there. So why don't I go there and report back to you on that? But like St. Petersburg, let me say this. St. Petersburg is just so sort of, it's like, let's say cyberpunk in a sense, but in a weird way. Like, you have all these palaces and old buildings in the city.
Like archaeo-futurism, kind of.
Yeah, that's the word. And at the same time, you got, like, giant plasma screen TVs screwed into it. And you got all these amazing, it's like the city, when you go to Europe and Germany, you have all this disgusting modernist cube bullshit going all over the place. You don't have that in Russia, thank God.
Well, what do you say about America? America has kind of like the crappiness of like the present suburbia in a lot of places. What I've heard about Moscow, it is kind of this like archaeo-futurism, like the ancient Russia, pre-communist Russia, the kind of Soviet brutalism, and then you feel like you're in Blade Runner, like where the ancient meets the future. In America, we're kind of stuck in this like crappiness of the present.
Yeah, exactly. No, but actually, Stalin was pretty base. Like, he made these amazing architectural wonders.
Oh, I talked about that with Konstantin von Hofmeister, like those, like, the palace of the Soviets, I think.
Yeah, they are great. I'm living in one right now, and it is fantastic. And all this, like, high skyscraper, Stalin-type stuff that you associate with Russia, I mean, it is fantastic. The shitty stuff came afterward with Khrushchev, who started building Khrushchevki, which were just these like mass-produced, total bullshit things. But even they look better than a lot of parts of Germany in terms of the Cubist suburbia. I mean, literally, traveling through Austria and Germany and staying in the suburbs, like, there are straight-up entire neighborhoods that look like Picasso's wet dream, where it's just these ridiculous transparent cubes and all that sort of stuff. And it's like that disgusting, sterile iPad-type future that you got going on. Russia's not like that. Russia's got this sort of blend of old and new, especially in St. Petersburg, where it's like this imperial city, and you got all these like new things just screwed on, basically. You got neon and shimmering lights advertising some little cafe right in the atrium of like a palace, or like this place I love to go to, which was an abandoned palace that some local kids took over. They paid a bribe, and they made it into this art complex where it's like all an abandoned palace that they retrofitted to make into a swivel haunt. And a lot of those themes are in Jack's play, this sort of, I wouldn't call it even cyberpunk. I don't know what to say. I guess it's archaeo-futurist. It's just uniquely Russian, I suppose. Buy my book.
And I'm working on a book, too, which also has an archaic kind of retro-futurist theme. There's one thing I'll touch on briefly is you wrote an article, The Alt-Right Should Support Gentrification, and you have this video from The Black Pigeon Speaks about a suburbia. But I think retreating out to like places like Idaho, that's very defeatist. Like my dream would be to sort of revitalize like these urban ghettos and build these like great retro futurist cities for the middle class.
Absolutely. I totally share that view. Living in Russia and living in cities where it's safe, I mean, it's insane. It really gives you inspiration. City living doesn't have to be so shitty. It doesn't have to be filled with and bad encounters with the third world. I mean, these cities are a testament to a people's cultural, historical, and engineering prowess. And when Americans surrendered their cities to basically live in cardboard shacks, McMansions, and all of that stuff with the green lawn and the, I mean, you kind of can't help but sympathize with the beatniks and the hippies when they started calling out this kind of culture. It was like, yeah, it's empty. It's a lot of people don't like it. A lot of people think that it's too consumerist or it's too bland. But one of the biggest red pills I ever had was when I realized that the suburbs were created intentionally as part of like a Stalinesque policy of diffusing dangerous minorities and getting them out of the cities where they could possibly be a threat to the Anglo ruling class, and basically sending Germans out, sending Poles, basically using blacks as basically a third world bomb to get white people to abandon entire sectors of the city. Getting the Italians out, getting all these ethnic enclaves out of the city.
Yeah, there were those big urban renewal projects, so I'm kind of advocating doing that in reverse, like taking these like inner ring rundown suburbs and revitalizing them into these retro futurist like self-contained cities that would like bring back all the middle class people who moved to the suburbs, but with like good schools and like self-contained skyscrapers.
Yeah, it sounds pretty intense, but like honestly, I totally agree. This idea of going further and further out into the next exurb because, the diversity moved in and all of that. It's so, I mean, Americans constantly talk about how they got my guns, but like, what's the point? I mean, you've given up every single bit of ground.
We're at the end of the show. I'd like to thank you for being on. We've covered a lot of really fascinating topics.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We should talk some more sometime.